From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, poet Donald Hall. His new collection is about life after the death of his wife, the poet Jane Kenyon. The book begins with this quote, "The true subject of poetry is the loss of the beloved." Also coming up, British actress Julie Christie, the star of such films as Darling, Dr. Zhivago, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and Shampoo. She's in Hal Hartley's new film, No Such Thing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Chad Pergram. The Mideast peace mission of Secretary of State Colin Powell grew more complicated today. Israeli police say a Palestinian bombed a bus in northern Israel that killed 8 passengers as well as the bomber. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said his military will press ahead with incursions into Palestinian areas. Sharon also said it would be a tragic mistake for Powell to meet with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. But Powell contends such a meeting is important.
He's the leader of the Palestinian people, and I think the Palestinian people and the Arab leaders with whom I've met over the last several days believe that he is the partner that Israel will have to deal with at some point.
He spoke in Madrid after a meeting with representatives from the United Nations, Russia, and the European Union. The European Parliament has adopted a resolution calling on its members to impose trade sanctions against Israel. Douglas Baxton reports from Luxembourg City.
The Parliament, meeting in Strasbourg, France, approved a resolution urging the 15-nation European Union to suspend its association agreement with Israel, which gives the Jewish state preferential trade terms. The vote is not binding on EU governments, whose foreign ministers meet in Luxembourg Monday to consider whether to hold an extraordinary session of the Association Council that oversees the agreement. The resolution called for an arms embargo of Israel and the Palestinian Authority. Spanish Foreign Minister Josep Piquet, whose country holds the EU presidency, told Spanish radio that the bloc is beginning to contemplate sanctions. Israel's defense ministry says Germany has already delayed delivery of parts for Israeli tanks. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Baxton in Luxembourg City.
More plaintiffs have come forward in the constitutional challenge to the new campaign finance law. NPR's Peter Overby reports from the Capitol.
Up till now, only Republican Senator Mitch McConnell, the National Rifle Association, and a handful of others had sued to challenge the McCain-Feingold law. Now 23 politicians and other plaintiffs have joined in. Georgia Congressman Bob Barr said that when President Bush signed the bill into law on March 27th, it reminded him of the terrorist attacks last September.
September 11th, 2001, and March 27th, 2002, have something in common. On both of those days, our nation was attacked, one militarily, the other through words, through legislation that strikes at the heart of the constitutional principles on which our nation was founded.
Except for the American Civil Liberties Union, all of the plaintiffs so far have Republican or conservative roots. Peter Overby, NPR News, the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 173 points to close at 10,381 in heavy trading of 1.4 billion shares. Advancing issues led declining issues. The Nasdaq earned 24 points to 1167. The S&P 500 gained 12 points to close at 1130. This is NPR News from Washington. The 4-decade-old Cincinnati Jazz Festival will not happen this summer. It was the latest victim of an economic boycott in the city. The festival usually draws about 50,000 people. Eileen LeBlanc, a member station WYSO, reports.
The boycott was called after the riots last April, which followed the shooting of an unarmed black man by a white Cincinnati police officer. The boycott has been successful in getting many name acts to cancel their plans to perform in the city, including Bill Cosby, Wynton Marsalis, The Temptations, and Prince. The festival, billed as the largest rhythm and blues festival in the country, lost its longtime sponsor Coors Light last summer and lost over $500,000. This year, with no corporate sponsor, slow ticket sales, and shaky headlines, headliners, the producer decided to pull the plug. Yesterday, a settlement for a racial profiling lawsuit against the city police was agreed on, but the boycotters say that that is just a first step toward their demands for fair treatment of African Americans in Cincinnati. For NPR News, I'm Eileen LeBlanc in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
The NAACP has joined a racial discrimination lawsuit against the Cracker Barrel restaurant chain. The class action suit accuses Cracker Barrel of segregating black patrons in the smoking section of restaurants. The president of Cracker Barrel, Donald Turner, denies the charges and says that service at the restaurant chain is, quote, colorblind. Michael Skakel, the nephew of Robert F. Kennedy, has proclaimed his innocence to the Associated Press. Skakel had not spoken to the media about his murder case until today. He's accused of beating his neighbor Martha Moxley to death with a golf club in 1975 when they were both 15 years old. Skakel could face life in prison if convicted. Chad Pergram, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, providing research and information on health issues to policymakers and the general public at kff.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It was 7 years ago this month that poet Donald Hall lost his wife, the poet Jane Kenyon, to leukemia. His new book is a collection of beautiful poems about going on without her. It's his second collection of poems related to her death. The first was called Without. Hall never expected to survive Kenyon. She had nursed him when he had cancer. Just a few months after he went into remission, she got her diagnosis. They met in 1969 when Hall was teaching at the University of Michigan and Kenyon was his student. They were married for 20 years and lived on Eagle Pond Farm in New Hampshire, which is still Hall's home. Both Kenyon and Hall had served as the state's poet laureate. Hall has received several awards for his writing, including the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize in Poetry, and the Frost Medal from the Poetry Society of America. His new book of poems, The Painted Bed, begins with this inscription from the Persian writer Fayiz Ahmed Fayiz. The true subject of poetry is the death of the beloved. I asked Hall why he chose this quote.
It struck me, and it struck me not only, of course, thinking about my late wife, Jane Kenyon, about whom I've written so much, but about the fact that so much poetry is loss, is written about loss. It is not merely a lamentation, but an attempt to preserve what is lost. So that this seemed to me eloquent about what poetry has typically done, certainly what my poetry over the years has typically tried to do.
Are you still writing poems about Jane?
Really, the last poem directly about Jane that I have started is a poem called The Wish in The Painted Bed. But there are others, many others, in which Jane makes her entrance. Jane or her death or my I Visit Her Graveyard. These are poems subsequent to The Painted Bed, poems that are still around.
I'd like you to read several poems from the new book. Let's start with the poem Barber. Feel free to introduce this in any way.
Yep. This poem Barber is one that took place not long before Jane's death, but when we still had some hope that she might live, and we were getting rid of some of the chemotherapy materials that we had had before. That's enough, I think, to say. Barber. Jane's brush cut looked like a Marine recruit's as she sat skinny and pale at the table, interrupting our chore to vomit in a china bowl. We picked through jumbles of medical supplies, filling two garbage bags with leukemia's detritus. When I lifted up leftover disinfectant or Duoderm, she shook her head no, and I tossed it away. As I did with the Ziploc of her massy hair, cut off the year before when it started to shed, the young barber trembled.
Donald Hall, are you surprised at what moments actually stick in your memory? And what moments you remember enough to use them as starting points for poems?
I guess I'm surprised. That generally they occur and reoccur and reoccur until I can no longer ignore them, and I get to the table and begin sketching out something about them. It's the recurrence that indicates to me that they have some depth or some resonance in me, and that perhaps then I should try to put them into the form of a poem.
And why did this moment become a poem?
Jane's hair was terribly important to her. Losing it was such a cruel thing. And when she had died, we were hopeful at the time I speak of, when we threw away the bag of hair. When she died, I wished so much I'd had some of this hair. And I kept thinking about it, thinking about the absence of her hair. And then remembered the scene when, early on in her leukemia, when she began to lose her hair, and she couldn't stand it, clumping on the floor of the shower stall every day as it began to go out, so that she we arranged for a barber to come from the barbershop in the hospital and shave it all off. I remembered. He was trembling, a young man. She was very moved by what he had to do.
When someone you love is dying and you know how limited your time together is, you have a sense that it's almost like your duty to engrave memories in your mind, so at least you have the memory after you lose the person. Is that something you became very self-conscious about, particularly as a writer who works with memory?
I don't think I was exactly self-conscious. I wouldn't use that word for it. I was just overwhelmed by necessity. I mean, it was what kept me going, really, to remember these things, to preserve them, to embody that loss by recounting events. I thought of things over and over again, like the time we went to a funeral shortly before she died and there was to be another funeral. These images, not language really, but recurrent images, like images in a dream, would come to me. And without self-consciously preserving, I would need to write them down.
Donald Hall, I'd like you to read another poem from your new book, The Painted Bed, also a poem about your late wife, the poet Jane Kenyon. And this one is called Sweater. Perhaps before you read it, you could just tell us something about the moment that inspired this poem.
Well, it took me a year before I could gather her clothes and send them off. And I write about that a little bit here. After I thought that I had picked up all her clothes, I kept finding more and more of her. Naturally, lived in the same place together for 20 years, and the remains are still there. They're fewer and fewer now. But even after I had sent her clothes away, I kept finding more. And this is the background of this poem. The second June afterward, I wrapped Jane's clothes for Rosie's place. But I keep on finding things I missed. A scarf hanging from a hook in the tool shed. A green down vest. Or a sweater tossed on the swivel chair by her desk where her papers pile untouched. Just as she left them. The last time she fretted over answering a letter or worked to end a poem by observing something as careless as the white sleeve of a cardigan.
When I read the poem, it made me think about a few things. One is that sense of like a moment frozen when somebody dies, that the whole landscape they left is just kind of frozen in place. And then you, the living, have to decide if you're going to change it at all, or how long you're going to leave it as a kind of living monument to them.
You have to do it. I think I've done what now, by this time, it's almost 7 years since Jane died. I think I've probably done what I had to do, but certainly the first years it was very hard to do what I had to do. I had to get rid of her clothes, to give them to some place where they could be useful. And also I did gather her clothes 2 years after she died. I did gather her papers, her drafts of poems, letters. That took me until about 2 years after she died before I could do that. Now I will rarely find anything. I've really come, finally, after 7 years, to a different place.
How did you know that you were ready to give away the clothes or collect the poetry and manuscripts?
You know, I knew from the beginning, when I knew she was dying, I knew I would have to do that eventually. And it's a process of getting closer and closer to what you can possibly do. For upwards of a year, I thought and thought about her clothes. Every time I would look at the back of the door to the bathroom, and there was her bathrobe and perhaps a nightshirt and so on, I would think, I've got to do it, I've got to do it. And I wasn't getting rid of her. I was doing what was necessary after her death. And I steeled myself toward doing it until finally I could. Some people can do it right away, and maybe that's healthier than me, but I just couldn't do it.
The last line of that poem, Sweater, refers to how sometimes when she would write, her images were inspired by something as haphazard as the white sleeve of a cardigan.
Absolutely, you've got it. That's just, they were, after Jane died, some of the time when I was writing about her, I felt as if I was writing for two. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, what would Jane do at this point in a poem? And in this poem, perhaps in particular, I'm talking about her desk where she sat to write. And I think there was, in fact, a cardigan over her desk chair. But I was seizing that particular the way she did. And sometimes in her poems, you can't intellectualize about the relevance of what she sees, but it's absolutely right. Well, here the relevance is obvious. It is a particular to end the poem with, but it's one that obviously takes its place in the structure and meaning of the poem.
Yeah, I wonder if you think that your poems about Jane Kenyon, your late wife, are different in any way from your other poems, if the writing style is different and if the writing style is more affected by her style, since there's so much about her.
Some of it is affected by her style. I know that the last poem in Without, called The Weeds and Peonies, that was the first one, actually, I wrote after her death. And I used some words that she particularly used, and I made allusion to a poem I'd written about her long ago. There I had the sense of us working together, as it were, more than in subsequent ones. I do think that the style of the Without poems, and maybe to a lesser degree of this book, the poems about her are quite different from what I had done earlier. They are, for the most part, more direct. People used to call Jane simple until, you know, she got tired of it, as if it were simple-minded, but she was. It took her a couple of years to rewrite her poems into this apparent simplicity. But I think that I tried to do something similar with many of these poems. I don't think they really sound like Jane, but I think I was, she was a kind of model, yes.
And do you think when you write poems about Jane, do you think that she would be glad that you're writing about her, since she was a poet, you were a poet? Poetry is one of the things you always had so in common with each other.
Oh, yeah. This was one of the ground bases. It's so hard to say. You know, one thing I've thought of so much, I was so much older than Jane, and I had been ill, and we all knew that I'd die early and she'd be a widow. What would she have written about me?
Right.
And I thought of that when I'm writing about her. Would she be writing in this way about me? There's no answer to it. I do like to think that, I'm quite sure she would have been pleased that I kept thinking about her for so long, and that this was at the front of my work life, to embody grief and to talk about her and, to a degree, her life.
My guest is poet Donald Hall. His new collection is called The Painted Bed. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is poet Donald Hall. His new collection, The Painted Bed, is about life after the death of his wife, the poet Jane Kenyon. She died of leukemia 7 years ago. I'd like you to read another poem from your new collection, The Painted Bed, and this is called Ardor. Would you introduce it for us?
Yes, I'll be happy to. Ardor is a poem that I wrote or began, 2 years after she died. If anything, things got a bit worse. It seemed hard to imagine that they could get worse. A year and a few months after her death, and for quite a while, I got depressed with the kind of violence of depression. Ardor comes out of this time, and I worked on it, I know, on a visit down to Florida, which I mentioned in it, but it came out of a time, perhaps something like a year and a half to 2 years after her death. Therefore, a state quite different from the poems that I wrote quickly, or not quickly, but soon after her death. Anyway, I'll read the poem. Nursing her, I felt alive in the animal moment, scenting the predator. Her death was the worst thing that could happen, and caring for her was best. After she died, I screamed, upsetting the depressed dog. Now I no longer address the wall covered with many photographs, nor call her you in a poem. She recedes into the granite museum of Jane Kenyon, 1947-1995. I long for the absent woman of different faces who makes metaphors and chops onion, drinking a glass of Chardonnay, oiling the wok, humming to herself, maybe thinking how to conclude a poem. When I make love now, something is awry. Last autumn, a woman said, I mistrust your ardor. This winter in Florida, I loathed the old couples my age who promenaded in their slack flesh, holding hands. I gazed at young women with outrage and desire, unable to love or to work or to die. Hours are slow and weeks rapid in their vacancy. Each day lapses as I recite my complaints. Lust is grief that is turned over in bed to look the other way.
Donald Hall, I just particularly like that line, she recedes into the granite museum of Jane Kenyon, 1947 to 1995.
Yep, yep. And it was true that I...
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. That I could no longer say you, as I did in earlier poems after her death. She was now she and her, just part of the measure of the receding that I speak of. And as she recedes into the granite monument, there is a hard stillness about her death. It's no longer vibrant and moving and, in motion. It is still.
You know, since this poem is about her receding and her memory receding, do you remember her as she was before she was sick or when she was sick?
Oh, for so long I could only remember her when she was sick. It was terrible. My dreams, my daydreams were of the... First, they were of the last 11 days when we knew she would die, and then it was of earlier times and the baldness and the suffering and the pain. Finally, I was able to remember her before. I remember her dream, the first dream, where she had a full head of hair, and she was the way she used to be, and that was such a relief. And now, really, when I think of her, I think of her, I guess, almost entirely when she was well. It's much better.
One of the lines in that poem, Ardor, is, when I make love now, something is awry. The implication being that you've had relationships subsequent
to your
late wife. And it's like a reality that's alluded to within these poems about grief. But it's like when I read this book, I just think of you as a man who experiences loss. And I have to keep saying to myself, too, there's more to your life, you know, that your life goes on. It isn't totally frozen in grief.
You know, one thing that this book has made clear to me is the distinction between the embodiment of the poems, that part of your life, and then the present life that has continued after the poems are finished. So that the private past comes, when I publish this poem, as a public present. And I am no longer in the places that these poems embody. I don't, of course, renounce them, therefore, but it is a bit strange. I am no longer in that place of mourning that many of these poems embody. And even the most recent of the poems, I began 2.5 years ago. I work on poems endlessly. I can't do them quickly. So I revise them and revise them. Then by the time they're published, I'm a long way from the moment that started them.
I'm going to ask you to read a poem that's a rhyming poem, which
yes.
I think is unusual for you.
When I began to write, my first book came out when I was 27. It was rhyme and meter pretty much all the way. And most of my life I've written forms of free verse. Free verse is so many different things. Actually, it is easier to write a poem in rhyme and meter, providing you, learned how to write it at some point or other, than it is to write a free verse poem. I mean something simple by that. At the same time I was writing these poems, I was working on other poems in free verse. And the free verse poems took at least twice as many drafts. When you start a poem in stanzas, you know something about what you're going to do in the next stanza. When you write one stanza, you know something about the next one. There are limits. There are
there's a form.
Requirements to fill. Mm-hmm. And with free verse, you want to improvise until you finish it so that it has a kind of fixity to it. But you don't know how you're going to achieve that fixity. You have to improvise until you find it. And there is more measurement, obviously, in the stanzaic poem.
Would you read The Wish?
Yes. This is the last of the of these rhymed poems. And actually, it's the last poem that I have written, which is directly a poem of mourning, The Wish. I keep her weary ghost inside me. Oh, let me go, I hear her crying. Deep in your dark you want to hide me, and so perpetuate my dying. I can't undo the grief that you weep by the stone where I am lying. Oh, let me go. By work and women half distracted, I endure the day and sleep at night to watch her dying reenacted when the cold dawn descends like twilight. How can I let this dream forget her white withdrawal from my sight and let her go? Her body as I watch grows smaller, her face recedes, her kisses colder. Watching her disappear, I call her, come back, as I grow old and older. While somewhere deep in the catch of sleep, I hear her cry as I reach to hold her, oh, let me go.
You said that that poem was the last poem you really wrote about mourning her.
Directly mourning. Mm-hmm. As I say, she is in other poems. And the tone is one of mourning or grief there. But this one is straight about the mourning. And, of course, it is a poem in which I have her ask me to let her go. That has to be me asking me in some ways.
So did you know that that would be the last poem of a series?
No, I really didn't. It, as I pulled away from this poem, I worked it over and worked it over. Then I began to be aware.
Poet Donald Hall will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and National Geographic, featuring travel products including guidebooks, maps, magazines, and trips, available in stores nationwide or online at nationalgeographic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actress Julie Christie. Her films include Darling, Dr. Zhivago, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and Shampoo. She's in Hal Hartley's new film, No Such Thing. And we continue our conversation with poet Donald Hall.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with poet Donald Hall. His book, The Painted Bed, is a collection of poems about life after the death of his wife, the poet Jane Kenyon. This month marks the 7th anniversary of her death from leukemia. This is Hall's second book of poems about Kenyon's death. Earlier in the interview, he said that he thought he had concluded his cycle of poems mourning her. Did writing poems of mourning for your wife and then ending that cycle coincide with being able to have relationships with other women afterwards?
It was, a steady process in both directions. Finally, I have been able to feel love. I did some dating. I had relationships earlier. But I had to move along past the place of the poem called The Wish before I could really let myself go into love of another woman. Jane is not gone. She'll always be there, goodness knows, but I am able to look elsewhere.
Right. I'd like you to read a poem now that isn't published in your new book. I don't know whether it's, it was written too late for the new book or it just doesn't fit with the theme of the new book, but this is about sitting with a woman who you're having a relationship with after Jane's death.
Right.
And say what you'd like to introduce it, and then you can.
All right. One thing I'll say to it is that I've told you I take 2 years to write a poem. This is a poem that I began only last February. I have the draft. Yes, and I'm sure it's not finished, but I'm happy to read it. This is draft number 25, and that is it makes it a neonate. I don't know, of course, what I'll change, and obviously I like it enough to read it now. But it is quite new, and it is a love poem out of my present, and thank goodness it is my present. From the porch. We sit on the porch, gloved hand in hand, to watch the cold white snowflake universe shake down multiple tiny geometries against blackness's zero. We keep silence, for sound would shatter the laden, luminous night that softens into sameness the fence post, car, and mailbox. Behind us, a lamp's light through a curtained window calls us away from virginal cold to huddle our bodies together in a quilted passion of comfort. We will wake to snow's harvest and the unmitigated sunshine of tea and of golden breakfast.
That's a lovely poem.
Thank you.
Is it a relief to be writing about relationships that are current, to be writing about a relationship that exists now, as opposed to be writing about, you know, mourning a death?
You know, when I wrote poems of mourning, I was relieved to write them. It relieved me. It's a sort of different sense from in which you're using it. I had to do it. If I turned my head away and looked elsewhere at that point, it would have been a bad thing for me. So I had to do it, and I use your word. I mean, it was a relief to do it. But certainly now to be at a point in my life, a point 7 years after Jane's death, when I can look elsewhere and when I can write happy poetry. This was a happy poem, The Golden Breakfast. That's a great relief indeed. Just lately, for the first time since January of 1994, I've been able to feel happy when I go to bed because I'll wake up in the morning. I used to feel that way a lot, and I hadn't for a long time.
There's a final poem I'd like you to read, and it's the poem that concludes your book. And the poem is called
Yes.
Affirmation. Would you talk about this before you read it?
I will, yes. This is a poem that ends The Painted Bed, and it may end that it ends the series of feelings that The Painted Bed embodies. And it's a possible feeling, and this poem has been, it's a very depressed poem, but it has been a poem that's had a great deal of response. I published it in a magazine, and I've had more letters about it than I think I ever have on any poem I've published in a magazine before. So that it must reach people. For me, it is the, You know, the private past becoming the public present. And I read it aloud to you, happily to read the poem, but also very aware that it represents or embodies something that is a long way from where I am now. Affirmation. To grow old is to lose everything. Aging, everybody knows it. Even when we're young, we glimpse it sometimes and nod our heads when a grandfather dies. Then we row for years on the midsummer pond, ignorant and content. But a marriage that began without harm scatters into debris on the shore, and a friend from school drops cold on a rocky strand. If a new love carries us past middle age, our wife will die at her strongest and most beautiful. New women come and go, all go. The pretty lover who announces that she is temporary is temporary. The bold woman, middle-aged against our old age, sinks under an anxiety she cannot withstand. Another friend of decades estranges himself in words that pollute 30 years. Let us stifle under mud at the pond's edge and affirm that it is fitting and delicious to lose everything.
At the end there, when you say, let's affirm that it is fitting and delicious to lose everything, I was wondering if you meant that as a kind of Zen moment or as a kind of bitter irony.
When I was writing it, sitting at my desk, when it came out of me, that is, it came out in a different form and then boiled down into this form, I was thinking of it as a bitter irony. And, you know, when you are working on a poem, you intend some things that, you know about. But if the poem is any good, and I will say this about any poem that anybody writes, there are things going on in that poem that you're not aware of at the moment of writing. I think it's almost essential for the poet to be someone who can say things that contain an underside of which he or she is not consciously aware. And many people responding to this poem have seen an affirmation at the end, which is not so much to affirm as to accept, but to accept and embrace the nothingness that or the loss of everything that is inevitable. So I've been hearing more and more of this, and I think, in fact, that although I was conscious of bitter irony, that I was, in fact, affirming in ways that I wasn't aware of.
The poem is largely about aging and
yep.
The things that you lose as you get older.
Right. And then, obviously, my particular losses.
Right,
But I generalize them, our and we. They could stand in for other people's losses.
Here's what I'm thinking. Often when you're younger, when one is younger, one isn't particularly interested in the musings or the poetry of being older, right? I don't know if you went through that as a younger reader.
I don't think I did so much because I grew up loving old people. I mean, grandparents and so on. But at any rate, I accepted generalization, certainly.
So I guess I was wondering if you had any reservations yourself about actually writing on the subject of growing older.
I have no reservations whatsoever. This is where I live now. I grow old and older, as I say in that other poem, The Wish, and I'm certainly aware of it. I'm feeling wonderful right now, and I'm not feeling particularly old, but I know I am.
How old are you?
I'm 73.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, I am aware that my years are considerable and that it's highly likely that I will not live forever. I'm aware of it without brooding about it much of any, because I am happy in my daily life now. When I was so unhappy in my daily life, my mortality, the gradual loss of everything, was more immediate to me. I'm not quite on the midsummer pond, but I am able to live now in the present, and that is in a present that has its joys. And, of course, that is, as you said earlier, a considerable relief.
Donald Hall, very good to talk with you again. Thank you so much for reading some of your poems.
Thank you for the opportunity. I always enjoy talking with you.
Donald Hall's new collection of poems is called The Painted Bed. Coming up, actress Julie Christie. This is Fresh Air. Actress Julie Christie has a lot of fans. Unfortunately, they don't get to see her in many new movies. But she accepted a role in Hal Hartley's new film, No Such Thing. In the 60s and 70s, Christie starred in such films as Darling, Petulia, Dr. Zhivago, and McCabe and Mrs. Miller. In the second half of the 90s, she was Gertrude in Kenneth Branagh's film Hamlet, and she received Best Actress Awards from the New York Film Critics and National Society of Film Critics for her performance in Alan Rudolph's film Afterglow. As Edward Guthman wrote in the San Francisco Chronicle, luminous and instinctive, Christie is the kind of actress whose performances seem to come without great effort and who, after delivering them, is perfectly content to walk away from the hype and ephemera of movie making. Julie Christie, you haven't been doing a lot of new movies. Why did you decide to be in Hal Hartley's new movie, No Such Thing?
I like Hal's movies very much indeed. They're a relief.
Relief from what?
Relief from all the other American movies. First one I saw was called Trust, was it?
Yes.
I think it was called Trust. And it was a long time ago, and I was actually shooting a film in Ireland at the time, and I remember seeing it and being absolutely thrilled and delighted. And I have a friend with whom I share, you know, new discoveries. We try to see films before anyone else does, and that he'd seen at a film festival. And so I rung him up immediately and said, I've seen this amazing film. And he was equally excited by it. And since then, I've been a real fan of Hal's work. I like it a lot. So although this is a very tiny part, I didn't want to say no to the opportunity. I don't suppose I'll get it again.
So did he call you up and ask you?
I think something like that, or wrote a letter. Wrote a letter, yes, a most lovely letter, yeah. Which is how I end up doing work. It's usually through the director.
And why aren't you making more movies? Why have you... It seems like it's your choice to make very few and to be very selective.
A lot of reasons. Well, one thing is, I kind of don't want to make. I've got to be careful about this because if you say you don't want to make movies, people don't offer you movies, and it might be just the one I like. But it's not. I don't want my life to be in that business particularly. I want it to be somewhere else. So I'm looking for something else to be... there's plenty of things to absorb me, but I'm looking for something which is consistent to do, and it's not movies. Partly because my memory is so bad. It's always been bad. I've always had a problem with my memories. Ages and ages ago, I have a problem doing plays for that reason. I was doing a... We were doing Uncle Vanya on Broadway. Now, when was that? I can't remember dates at all. I have so I can't tell you when it was. And remembering those lines was a nightly horror. So it took away from the actual acting. And I really have a real problem remembering lines. Of course, in films, it's not nearly as serious, but it's still there. I mean, you still have to remember and say things if you have a script. And I just not... I've never been completely dedicated to acting, to being an actor. And very different from most actors who are very dedicated people. And I've never been that. So it's just a weaning away.
Since memory is such an issue for you, or forgetting, I'd like to talk with you about memory. One of the things that an actor really needs is the ability to remember lines. And it's particularly true on stage where mm-hmm. you're doing the whole play. But even in movies where you're maybe shooting a scene at a time, you still have to remember. Was memory an issue when you started your acting career? Did you ever think of yourself then as having trouble remembering your part?
Terry, I can't remember. That's the truth. But I can remember, as I say, up to, I was talking about the play I did in, I can remember back to then having trouble. I remember then having trouble, the play I did on Broadway. I just did a couple of plays in London, and boy, did I have trouble then, and so did the other people, because if you can't remember your lines, you know, it's the other people who are in trouble. I mean, I never dried, but I made things up. I can't remember in films whether it was a problem. I just can't remember. And I know it's a problem now because it's with me. You know, I can know what is actually happening now. I can remember what is happening. I am sitting at a table talking to Terry Gross. Yes, I remember that.
So what's your technique for learning lines now to try to compensate for the faulty memory?
I had the good fortune to meet a wonderful acting teacher, and of course I can't remember when. And she was wonderful on many, many levels. You see, if you get into acting too early, I think it's a very bad thing. I mean, if you become famous too early, I think it's a bad thing for your acting, because you start to be used over and over in roles that you actually aren't equipped for, because you haven't done the work and the training. And sort of halfway through my career, maybe later than that, I met this wonderful woman and started to learn, you know, a lot about acting. And it was marvelous, because it made me much more secure. And she also taught me how to learn lines, which is a very, if you can't remember, which is a very, very, very long, drawn-out process, which basically invests every word with something, and every sentence with a memory catch, you know, a hook. And it's a very, as I say, it just takes a long time. And that's another reason, you know, I'm quite happy not to work in films in acting, because the bit before is so long. It takes so long to do that work, that memory work.
Are you ever afraid that when you're in a movie or on stage and you're struggling to remember what your lines are, that struggle will somehow register in your face or in your eyes?
You always are. Everybody is. That is the fear that every actor has. On stage, you can... I'm just thinking of my last the experiences I've had of that. I don't think it does register, to be honest. I think we can hide it well. I think that's one thing we can do, is hide it, actors, as part of the acting, I think. And it on the much more personal close up of a film, you would just cut. It's lovely.
My guest is actress Julie Christie. She's in the new Hal Hartley film, No Such Thing. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Julie Christie, the star of such films as Darling, Dr. Zhivago, Petulia, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and Shampoo. She's in the new Hal Hartley film, No Such Thing. When we left off, she was telling us that she's always had a very bad memory, and she has difficulty memorizing her lines. Now, you're not that interested in making a lot of movies. You're very selective, and you're just as happy to work very little. If you didn't feel that way, if you wanted to work a lot more, I imagine this is a subject you wouldn't be very comfortable talking about. It's something you might be covering up, in fact.
What, my memory?
Yeah.
Never thought about it. you mean because the director of my dreams might not hire me? Don't
exactly.
worry, director of my dreams,
exactly.
I'll pull it off. No, well, you know... if somebody what listens to this and thinks they don't want to hire me because of my memory, I'll just... It's just... I don't think they would, because, you know, they know, they've seen me. They know what they want. Memory or no memory, people know what they want. The memory doesn't get in the way of what the audience sees. That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
It gets in my way, but not in the way of what the audience sees.
It's a nice way of putting it.
Mm.
Have you ever been to, like, a neurologist about your memory and tried to get, you know, see if there's any kind of, like, medical explanation for not being able to remember things?
Yeah. And that was the woman who told me I had autobiographic amnesia, and then she told me. But she was dealing
with... Wait, she actually gave a name to it?
Yeah.
I've never heard of that. Autobiographic amnesia?
That's what she said, yeah.
Is that just like a description she made up, or is that actually the name of something?
I don't know. That's what she called it. And so basically, there are such serious memory losses going on in the world, and mine is relatively unserious compared to those, and I don't think they can really be bothered very much with something as livable with as mine, when their job is to look after the sort of people I've been to anyway. Their job is to look after very, very seriously memory impaired people.
Mm-hmm.
They say I just got a bad memory. That I don't know what it is, you know.
Did you see the movie Memento about a man who develops a rare form of amnesia and he can't make new memories? So he tattoos all the things he needs to remember,
yes,
on his body.
I did see it, and I kept thinking, this is a really boring film. I live this all the time. What am I watching it for?
No, I'm wondering if you feel it's easier for you to live in the moment since you're not preoccupied with the past.
Easier than who? I don't know. We all try to live in the moment, don't we?
Yes, but many of us fail.
It's a very difficult thing to live in the moment. Very, 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 very difficult. Very difficult with our ant brains going all over the place. It's what I aspire to, but that's all I can say. It's what I aspire to. That's probably when we're all happiest, living in the moment.
Just one other question about this. I know the man who is either a close friend or a longtime companion of
mm-hmm.
yours is a journalist,
mm-hmm.
and it's the job of a journalist to remember accurately what you have witnessed so that you can report accurately on it. You must marvel at his ability to remember and to trust his memory.
I marvel at many people's ability to do that. I love it. It's wonderful. I don't want the memory of another friend of mine who remembers, two friends of mine who remember everything from the past and are slightly blighted by this persistent nostalgia. They remember everything. And I think if you remember everything in detail and with great clarity, it's that in itself is rather... It makes for a kind of sadness, because the loss is always... This is what I have observed in them, because the loss is always... real. You know, it doesn't fade. And that's the thing about memory, losing memory, is that you don't remember the bad things. And I don't remember the bad things. I mean, I have a memory of good things.
That sounds right.
I remember anything at all. I remember they're good things, they're not bad things. And even the bad things get sort of, when this happened or that happened, they're not involved with emotion. That's what it is. They're not involved with my emotion. So even the very, very terrible things are terrible by name, but not emotionally.
Julie Christie. She's in Hal Hartley's new film, No Such Thing. This year marked the centennial of composer Richard Rodgers' birth. We're going to celebrate with a concert of his songs, performed by Dave Frischberg and Rebecca Kilgore. We'll record the concert on Monday and play it sometime in the next few weeks. In the meantime, here's Frischberg and Kilgore from their latest CD, The Starlit Hour, singing the Rodgers and Hart song, 10 Cents a Dance.
$0.10 a dance, that's what they pay me. Gosh, how they weigh me down. $0.10 a dance, pansies and rough guys, tough guys who tear my gown. 7 to midnight, I hear drums, loudly the saxophone blows. Trumpets are tearing my eardrums, customers crush my toes. Sometimes I think I've found my hero, but it's a queer romance. All you need is a ticket. Come on, big boy, 10 cents a dance.
Dave Frischberg and Rebecca Kilgore from their CD, The Starlit Hour. Fresh Air's executive producer is Denny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House. Publisher of Yoga Gems, a treasury of practical and spiritual wisdom from ancient and modern masters, edited by George Feuerstein, Ph.D. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Jeffrey Rosen tells us how the CIA and Silicon Valley are partnering to develop new anti-terrorist technologies. Rosen's article will be in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. And journalist Jeffrey Toobin discusses his profile of Attorney General John Ashcroft, published in this week's New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.